Let me just start with a very basic question, and I'll just throw it to either one of you, whoever wants to pick this up first. Are African Americans still disenfranchised?
Well, I think it depends on what you mean by disenfranchised. Certainly, look at the legal level, you've got a disproportionate number of felons owing to a racist criminal justice system who are unable to vote, unable to gain access to jobs with a living wage. When you talk about right to housing, we were just there with folk here in Madison struggling for the right to gain quality housing, still the right to health care, even given the new health care bill under Obama administration. There's certain fundamental rights stipulated by the UN Declaration of Rights that many Americans don't have, not just black people. And so it depends on what you mean by disenfranchised.
Mm-hmm. Tavis?
African Americans, even with a black man in the White House as president, African Americans still lag far behind in every single leading economic indicator category. There's not a single economic indicator category where African Americans do not lag far behind. And some weeks ago when that Pew research study came out, Steve, that talked about the loss of black wealth, that talked about the gap between the have-gots and the have-nots in black and white terms, it underscores yet again that not only are we disenfranchised, to your question, we are more disenfranchised now than we've been in a long time. Life for African Americans in this country right now is at depression era levels. We've been hearing this phrase, you know, this is the worst recession since the Great Depression. We've heard that across the board, the worst recession since the Great Depression. Well, for black folk, we are now at depression era levels. And the real danger is that when Obama was ushered into the White House, this conversation began amongst our colleague, Steve, that we are now living in a post-racial America.
Right.
Dr. West, I pushed back on that consistently. America may be, indeed is, less racist to have elected Obama as president. Less racist, but not post-racial.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask about him. You've both mentioned Barack Obama here. We've got a black president. It would seem to be the epitome of the enfranchisement of African Americans.
Oh, at the legal level, there's no doubt that the election of a brilliant and charismatic president, Barack Obama, was a major breakthrough given the history of slavery and Jim Crow. The problem is he's a neoliberal abroad. He's a neoconservative. Neoconservative abroad, neoliberal at home. And therefore, he's still very much a part of the structural constraint of a system that is fundamentally tilted against poor and working people. So that, again, at the legal level, he represents unprecedented achievement. That's a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. That's symbolic. It results from tremendous struggle, blacks, white, red, yellow, and others. But when you look at right to jobs with a living wage, right to quality housing, right to health care, right to safety in a community without bullets flowing. You still see a disproportionate number of black folk.
And how much of that responsibility goes to the president, in this case to Barack Obama? I mean, can you hold him accountable for this? I mean, you know, it's a huge bureaucracy that he's in charge of, huge political problems.
My dear brother, Tavis Smiley, who I'm always so blessed to work with after 20-some years in this poverty tour, that it's something that is changing our lives. He wrote a book called Accountable. So I think he's got a lot to say about the accountability of the president.
I think every president has to be held accountable. When Barack Obama, President Obama, says to black America, as he has said many times when asked specifically why he won't address head-on problems that plague the black community, he has said consistently, I'm the president of all of America, as if black folks somehow aren't Americans too. Black folk need to have their issues addressed and in some cases redressed, not because they're black, but because they're catching the most hell, because they're the ones most in pain, because they're the ones who are having lives that are becoming less and less democratized on a regular basis. So that if you were in a car accident, Steve, and they rushed you to the hospital with head trauma, I would hope they would not start operating on your left foot. You respond to where the pain is most acute. And so in that regard, black folk and brown folk for that matter, and Native American brothers and sisters are not asking for respect and not asking for resources because they're black, you know, red, yellow, or brown, but because that is where the pain is most acute. Again, back to that Pew study of weeks ago about where this country is feeling the pain the most. And so every president has to be held accountable. But I believe that we have to understand that accountability is a beautiful thing. If you ever find yourself in a relationship, personally or professionally, and your partner does not want to be held accountable, get out as quickly as you can. Accountability is a good thing in relationships, indeed, for politicians. The bottom line is this, that Dr. West and I have said consistently were, and this is a Westian formulation, I can't take credit for this because he's in the room. Were he not, Steve, I would tell you this is a Tabas original. I'd be lying. But since he's here, I can't take credit for this. But this is a Westian formulation where Obama is concerned. We must respect the president. We must protect the president. We must also correct the president. We always respect the president. And when he needs to be protected against vicious, vulgar, vitriolic, racist, white supremacist, Tea Party, Donald Trump attacks, we will protect the president. He must always be respected, protected, but also corrected. This president is not Jesus. He doesn't walk on water. He makes mistakes. In many ways, he's afraid to address African-American issues, to your point, directly, because he's afraid of being accused of being tribal. And so he gives a standard response that I'm the president of all of America, and never gets around to really addressing the problems that are acutely impacting African-Americans. Although, when gays and lesbians jump up and down about don't ask, don't tell, and he should have done it sooner than he did, I'm glad he finally did it, but he responds to that particular constituency.
And you're saying he very rarely speaks specifically to African-Americans.
Not rarely, never. It's not a question of rare, it's a question of never.
So you have a real problem with this, I'm the president of all America. I mean, he is, obviously.
He is.
But you're saying that he needs to do more than that. I mean, he needs to address specifically
but
concerns
of
African Americans.
But any president who says he's the president of all America means on the ground that he responds to those who have most money, most resources, and most pressure. So when he goes to the business roundtable and says, I am the president of all America, they know exactly what he's talking about. Namely, he's going to speak to their interests before he speaks to poor people's interests because they have money, resources, and influence. And everybody knows that. So let's just get beyond the rhetoric in terms of this generic formulation of I am president of everyone. The thing I think that's most upsetting about Barack Obama, and here I think it's a philosophical point about democracy, that we know that the great contributions of the United States to world civilization have to do with the various ways in which we affirm the dignity of everyday people. It could be Emerson, it could be Whitman, it could be Muriel Rukeyser, it could be Louis Armstrong, it could be Duke Ellington, it could be Gershwin, it could be Sondheim, it could be Frank Lloyd Wright. All of these had democratic sensibilities having to do with finding the genius in everyday people, the extraordinary and ordinary people. Well, black people have a tradition from Frederick Douglass to Martin King of a reconstruction of democracy. That's why I even have a show on democracy. When you talk about black folk, it's a matter of what does democracy look like in the tradition of black people struggling against slavery, against Jim Crow, and now against Jim Crow Jr. And when you look at that tradition, King is probably the major figure. Mm-hmm. And Barack Obama mobilized King's legacy and then channeled it in neoliberal, centrist, democratic leadership council-like ways, and that for me is a form of political blasphemy. Mm. Blasphemy. Because when black people have talked about democracy at our best, from Douglass to Du Bois to King to Fannie Lou Hamer to Ella Baker, what have we meant? We never meant black self-interest. Never. We've talked about justice for everybody. We talked about fairness for everybody. Right? We want due process, 14th Amendment, for everybody. We want equal rights voting for everybody. And at the end of King's life, he was talking about poor people having what? Dignity for everybody in the economic sphere, cultural sphere, and so forth. So that King's legacy to be bastardized in that way requires tremendous revision and reconstruction on our behalf. And that's what Tavis and I are wedded to.
Well, let me move the discussion away from President Obama and ask a more general question about leadership. Does Black America have a leadership problem now?
Let me answer first this way, Steve. And I'm not pushing back on you. I just want to say this to these types of questions. I always get tickled. I used to get angry, but as I've gotten older, I try to laugh it off. I get more tickled now by questions about Black leadership. And I get tickled because I've never in my entire 20-year career ever been asked a question about assessing white leadership. But people are quick to ask a question about Black leadership as if somehow there is Black leadership and white leadership. There is good leadership and there is bad leadership in all kinds of communities. But this notion of Black leadership is always fascinating for me because it suggests that somehow there's a different paradigm here. And I think that leadership is about the same for all of us. And here again, I come back to my dear and abiding friend, Dr. West, who taught me many, many, many years ago the best definition, Steve, of leadership I've ever heard in my life. And it's a colorless definition of leadership. I don't typically believe in color blindness. I do in this Westian sense. Leadership, Dr. West defined this way for me many years ago. You can't lead people unless you love people. You can't save people unless you serve people. I don't care what kind of leader you fancy yourself to be, Black, white, red, brown, or yellow, corporate, public, doesn't matter. Teacher, lawyer, community organizer, radio talk show host, whatever your calling, your purpose, your vocation is, if you would call yourself a leader, you have to fit that definition. I'm not talking about not just leadership, but servant leadership. So it's not Black leadership or white leadership. It's about servant leadership. And again, Dr. West defines it as leading people by loving people, saving people by serving people. So the question is, whether you're Black, white, red, brown, or yellow, if you call yourself a leader, one, what is the depth of your love for everyday people? And secondly, what is the quality of your service to them? Dr. King said anybody can be great because anybody can serve. All it takes is a heart full of grace and a soul generated by love. So do we have a Black leadership problem by that definition? You're absolutely right. But do we have a white leadership problem by that definition? You're absolutely right. Too many leaders who are loveless, too many leaders who don't understand that leadership is not about being out front, not about the titles, not about the degrees, not about the car you drive or the house you live in or the friends you have or the access you have. Leadership is about loving and serving people. And by that definition, I think all of America is being let down by its leaders of every race, color, creed, and religion.
Well, Cornell, let me turn that question to you. I mean, should we take this idea of Black leadership off the table and just sort of get rid of those words,
No. I think the world has so much to learn from Black people. That's like taking Black music off the... No. Curtis Mayfield lives forever. I think what Tavis is saying is it's a human affair. And Black people are on a human continuum. And therefore, anytime you ask the question, it's always an inherent comparative question. And Tavis just wants to always ensure that in asking that question that we're not off the continuum, as it were. And we know that you understand the continuum very well. Your own rich legacy here. But it's always something to remind our audience in this regard. That when you talk about leadership of any color in America, you have to begin with the premise in 2011 that America is both a democratic experiment that is very precious but in deep trouble, and also an empire. Over 750 military installments around the world, a ship in every ocean, almost $1 trillion military budget. And that empire and democratic experiment is in decline, in relative decline, and the culture is in decay in terms of the souls of the peoples, especially the young peoples. When my empty souls, what I talk about, not enough empathy, not enough compassion, not enough courage. I think part of what Tavis has in mind in talking about the relative lack of leadership is that in a society in which oligarchs and plutocrats rule almost in an uncontested way, most of your leaders of any color are up for sale. And that's true no matter what color. And you cannot reproduce the best in your democracy, just like you can't produce the best musicians, the best artists, the best dancers, if all they're concerned about is just making money. You just can't do it. Mm-hmm. And right now, I think, and Martin saw this, Fannie Lou saw this, Ella Baker saw it in ways that most people didn't. Now, Phil Berrigan saw it too, you know, and Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel saw it too, so Black people have no monopoly on this. But when you look at the history of America, you'll find a disproportionate number of Black leaders who have been speaking this kind of language for a long time because they've been stigmatized, terrorized, and traumatized by slavery, Jim Crow, the various forms of white supremacy.
But let me maybe sort of try to rephrase the question, sort of talk about the specific backgrounds that each of you come out of. How much do intellectuals matter in the struggle for democracy?
Intellectuals always matter because ideas matter. I mean, part of what we're dealing with now is the triumph of right-wing ideas put forward by intellectuals, generated by think tanks, and now gaining access in the last 30 years to universities, shaping the very narrow corporate media with truncated options and limited alternatives made available to the American people. And as greed is good.
So you're saying sort of the conservative movement, the conservative revolution, was founded by conservative intellectuals.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, all the discussions we had, William Buckley and the others pushing the free markets, unregulated markets, and unfettered markets. Well, you know, they won. They convinced Larry Summers. They convinced Bill Clinton. They convinced Robert Rubin, as well as the disciples of Milton Friedman. And for a while, right, most of the economists said, what? We're all Milton Friedmanians. Well, that's an intellectual battle. Now, after 2008, when the greed is good model was shattered, right, it became clear they didn't really know what they're talking about. Oh, my God, they can't even run the system. These markets aren't self-sufficient at all. It generates fraud, indecent action, illegal action, criminal action, and so forth. And so on. So that the battle over ideas is always very, very important.
So I guess the question is why? I mean, why did the conservative intellectuals win, or at least gain the ascendancy right now? I mean, what about the intellectuals on the left?
Well, I mean, one, the liberals had marginalized the left in the 70s, and the liberal model itself began to be not just interrogated and called into question, but was unable to deliver. And the American people are in this yin-yang. If you don't go for the Democrats, then you got to go for the Republicans. So if the choice is between, well, milquetoast liberalism is not working and this mean-spirited Republicanism got a lot of energy and conviction, and let's try it out. More and more people opted for the right-wing version. Now that's being contested. And this is what we mean by decline. You know, what we witnessed in 2011 is the exhaustion, the relative exhaustion of milquetoast liberalism, mean-spirited conservatism. Where do we go? That's a deep question. That's very much what Dennis and I are wrestling with in terms of the legacy of Martin King.
Yeah.
And I think Steve, to build on Doc's point, if anybody can ever build on a brilliant point made by Dr. West, The democracy is in trouble so long as we think that we can live in a country where 1% of the people own and control more wealth than 90% of the people. My read of history, and I'm so glad you're doing this wonderful series on democracy, because my read of history suggests to me that there is no empire, back to Doc's framework about empire, there is no empire in the history of the world that at some point did not falter or fail. Every empire at some point fails. And I don't know if it is our arrogance, our hubris, our patriotism that has now morphed into nationalism. I don't know what it is that doesn't allow us to even consider that, like every other empire, at some point we could fail as well. This could be the beginning of the end. Now, as you well know, to say that, and I'm sure you'll get mail about this when this airs, to say that gets one labeled anti-American. So you got to be careful when, where, and how you say that, even on public radio. But at the end of the day, every empire has eventually failed. And I believe that this country one day is going to implode, or put another way, get crushed under the weight of its own poverty. If we don't figure out a way to eradicate poverty, I believe one day is ultimately going to eradicate us.
What you mean. Well, how would poverty eradicate us?
Poverty will eradicate us in that you can't have this gap continue to grow between the have-gots and the have-nots. It can't happen. Dr. West mentioned earlier, at the end of Dr. King's life, King was trying to raise this very point. There is no no empire, no country in the world. What we just saw recently in Egypt and in Tunisia and still now ongoing in Libya, when you see these uprisings around the world, it happens because the poor at some point get restless. Those who are economically and politically and socially and culturally disenfranchised eventually get to a point, as I like to say, where they become like Popeye. the cartoon character. I done stoods all I can stands, and I can't stands no more. And then with Popeye, out comes the can of spinach. Well, the proverbial or the metaphorical can of spinach are the protest. People take, and y'all know something about that here in Wisconsin. You know something about that. But at some point, people get restless. People get tired. It was Fannie Lou Hamer who said, "I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired." At some point, people start to feel that. And that's when that energy gets channeled into a certain way. And if you don't address poverty, you don't talk about eradicating poverty, poverty may end up eradicating your empire. Because at some point, it bubbles up to a point where people can't take it anymore, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. Well, I asked Dr. West about the question about intellectuals, so I want to turn to you, Tavis, now, a question about the media. And I don't know how you identify yourself mainly as journalist, media mogul,
just don't
maybe.
Call me anything. Just don't call me late for dinner, Steve.
So the question is, how much can a very prominent media figure like yourself play in fostering democracy? I mean, how much influence can you have?
Yeah, I'd like to put that question, that theory, to the test with all of my friends in the media, because I think in many ways that our democracy is suffering in part because of the complicity of those of us, the silence of those of us who have access to microphones and to TV cameras, and those who make decisions about what is and is not going to be covered. I think the media has a significant role to play in protecting, in preserving, in fostering, in making real the ideals and the promises of this democracy in this country. And so
in what way is the media failing?
Right, I think a lot of ways. One, I think the media is not focused as it should be on the right stories. The media not asking the right questions, not challenging folk to reexamine the assumptions they hold, not really helping people to expand their inventory of ideas, too often getting rolled by the political powers. And it happens under Republicans and Democrats. When George Bush was president and declared that the media would not be allowed to cover bodies coming back home to Dover Air Force Base. I mean, war is hell. And if we're going to go into war and you believe that there's justification for being in war, then let the American people wrestle with what the results of war are. But to be told, the media told, you will not cover bodies coming back, so that we can't really see on a regular daily basis on the nightly news, as we did in Vietnam, what's really happening. That's the media's complicity. They got rolled by the Bush administration.
What should they have done? Should they have just said, we're going to cover it?
Oh, absolutely. They should have said, we're going to cover it. They should have protested. They should have shown up. They should have sued the administration. They should have done whatever the media needed to have done to get that story covered, number one. Number two, so oftentimes they're not asking the right questions. Again, Republicans and Democrats, we are partly in this economic mess we are in right now because there were a handful of people who were trying to raise these questions, but the media wasn't asking the right questions of the right people. They weren't probing enough. They weren't digging enough. They weren't profiling enough. The media could have done something to ring the bell a little bit louder, to shake the trees, whatever metaphor you want to use. The media could have done more and should have done more. Those who report on these stories, to stop. You got all these business channels every day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and nobody. I mean, my friend Jim Cramer was saying that the economy was about to turn around. I mean, the media got, the news media, the business news media, got this story so wrong.
Maybe they just didn't know what was going on. Maybe they were just mistaken, as opposed to, you know, not asking the right questions.
But it's their job. It's their job to not be mistaken that way. And I accept that for one or two journalists, but the whole industry of them missed this particular story. And thirdly and finally, because I want to, again, cover both Republicans and Democrats, with President Obama, the media has not stayed on him as they should to remind him of what all of the polls have been indicating, which is that the American people want him to focus on jobs, jobs, jobs. So the media is about scoring points. It's about getting ratings. It's about selling papers. So they follow where they are led. But everybody knows that what matters most to the American people is the economy. And we keep letting this president get away every so many months with another speech that says, and now I'm going to focus on jobs. And now I'm going to focus on jobs. So my point is not to cast aspersion on Barack Obama as president, but to give examples of Republicans and Democrats where the media gets rolled by these elected officials and others. They get rolled by Wall Street.
So you're saying that the media basically just, in this case, takes President Obama at his word. Okay, if he says we're going to focus on jobs, they say, okay, oh, good. You know, you said that, whereas there's no follow-up?
They need to dig. They got to dig a little deeper, and they got to care a little bit more. And I think a lot of it it has to do, or some of it has to do, Steve, with who these people are asking the questions, raising the issues, conducting the profiles, and whether or not there is a real empathy on their part for everyday people who are catching hell. You know, I find that the things I talk about are easy for me to talk about because I care about them. It's easy for me to ask this question or that question. People say to me sometimes, and I'm not saying it's to pat myself on the back, but when I get people who say to me, "You're so courageous to do that, and that was so brilliant of you to do this, and I love you for asking those tough questions. I love you for doing this, that, or the other." And I say thank you, and we all want to be respected and appreciated for what we're trying to do, but I never see it that way. These are the issues that I care about. And when I get on the air, this is the stuff that I talk about. It's not going out of my way to do it. I raise these issues. I conduct these conversations. I profile these people because I care about these issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, Cornell, on this question of democracy, what do you think the media is not addressing? What are the questions that aren't being asked?
Well, I think Tavis's point is that if you had a media that was fundamentally committed to Socratic questioning, then they would be highly suspicious of the limited frameworks in which so many of the stories are cast. So that, for example, look at the bipartisan consensus on the prison industrial complex. When was the last time we had a serious discussion about the $300 billion we've spent on expanding the prison industrial complex between 1980 and 2011? We had 300,000 in 1975. Now we got 2.3 million. Other than lockdown shows that often dehumanize the folk already there. Where is the serious interrogation? This is what Sister Michelle Alexander is talking about, the new Jim Crow. The Socratic questioning often is trumped by sensationalizing stories that tie to the bottom line and money making. And there's an intimate connection between the corporate media complex, the military industrial complex, the Wall Street oligarchic complex, and the what would be the last one that feeds into it, which is actually the, really that's the four. It's the corporate complex, it's the military industrial complex, it's the Wall Street complex, and the fourth one would be what?
The body politic itself.
Well, the body politic itself, yeah, but yeah. I mean the government, the public officials themselves are complicitous in that regard. Mm-hmm. So what happens is, it's what Weber called an iron cage, where you get limited access to ideas, limited sensibility, limited empathy. And even if it's a golden cage, people who have a lot of money, they're still actually in a cage because they're unable to get out. And by being unable to get out, you can't constitute public space. There is no democratic experiment worth its salt without a vital public space, which must have a public conversation.
So getting back to the question of the media then, I mean, you're saying, I mean, my God, you know, this you've put this in global terms here.
Absolutely, because we're talking about...
It's kind of overwhelming. I mean, sort of, can you sort of get a little more, I don't know, pragmatic in a sense of, you know, what specifically would be some of the questions that you want to see right now in the New York Times that you're not reading?
Well, I wish that Paul Krugman's views were actually much more widespread because he tells more of the truth. I wish that Tavis Smiley show and the Amy Goodman show were actually mainstream shows because they tell more of the truth. It's just simply the case. I mean, I have nothing personally against Brother Bill O'Reilly or Brother Sean Hannity. It's just that they're not good in telling the truth at all. They have a right to be wrong. Don't get me wrong. I'm a libertarian in this regard. But the degree to which they have such massive influence and they're not telling the truth. At all, they just not, and it's connected to the academy because the academy itself is also tied to the narrow framework generating these folk. You see, that accents smartness, but smartness not connected to compassion or courage. Just smartness in order to make money, careerist, opportunistic, get over by any means, make big money, or obsession with the 11th commandment, thou shalt not get caught. You lose the best of your society, and each one of those complexes that I talked about. You can find that at work, from the military to the corporate media to the prison industrial complex.
If I can just add right quick, because I want to answer your question expressly. I hear what you're getting at, and I'm just give you my answer on this. Where in the American media, speaking of stuff that we want to see covered, is there any coverage, significant coverage about poverty, about the poor? Mm. everybody in Washington, everybody in New York, everybody in the national media knows that this debt ceiling legislation passed recently. This is not political ideology here. These are facts. It did not include an extension of unemployment benefits, as you know. It did not close a single corporate loophole. It did not raise one new tax revenue, so that Wall Street got away again. Corporate America got away scot-free again. The rich and the lucky got away again. Everybody knows that deficit reduction by definition, a third grader can tell you that deficit reduction by definition means a whole bunch of stuff is going to get cut. We now have some idea what the stuff is that's going to get cut. And we now know there are 12 people in a democracy in this super congressional committee who get to make those decisions. Where is the outrage in the media about that? And who is talking about the poor? And who's talking about the fact that deficit reduction, like war, is the enemy of the poor? There's another story for you. These wars are ongoing, and nobody is making the case that the trillions of dollars being spent on these wars, as Dr. King would say, that money being spent on those war makes war an enemy of the poor. These are the kinds of questions that aren't being asked. These are the kinds of issues that aren't being raised. These are the kinds of topics that are not being addressed. And again, I don't know how we expect or think that our democracy is going to survive when the very nature of that democracy is so fragile, in part because the media, to your question, doesn't cover the kinds of stuff that it ought to be covering, because the media is much more content, Steve, as you well know, to cover the news in terms of, and I hate this framework, but I watch it every night. The media loves to cover the news in terms of one simple framework: winners and losers.
The horse race.
The horse race. That's all they want to cover: winners and losers. And that is the frame through which we watch our news every night. So that if you want to see, you want to root for your team in the winner and loser battle, you watch Fox. If you want to root for your team, you watch MSNBC. So that everybody is watching the same stuff framed for them as winners versus losers, and you never get to the truth. And as Dr. West says all the time, it is the telling of the truth that allows the suffering to speak. So the suffering of the American people in this fragile democracy never gets surfaced. It gets rendered invisible if somebody doesn't speak to it, and the media doesn't do that.
Mm-hmm. We're running short of time here. A wrap-up question. You said earlier, the question that you two talk about, okay, what's to be done? Huge question, obviously, but for starters, where do you go?
Well, one is you've got to be like the Sankofa bird and look back at and be in contact with the best of the past in order to move forward. That's why the Whitmans and the Emersons, and that's why the Martin Kings and Fannie Lou Hamers, and that's why the Sondheims make a difference. We're talking about art, we're talking about politics. Young people need to be informed by and inspired by the best of the tradition of those who came before. And what did they do? They thought boldly. What did they do? They acted courageously and compassionately. And what did they do? They were willing to live and die for something bigger than themselves. Those are all three preconditions for any revitalization of any democracy. And if you don't have either one of them, you're going to lose your democracy and you end up with a crypto-fascist regime. And those folk who struggled in the past, they cry from their graves.
My answer simply and quickly is, and I know this may be a pipe dream, Steve, but we have to have more people who are willing to tell the truth. It's that simple for me. People who are willing to tell the truth, put another way, people who are willing, I don't mean just now media people, I mean Americans of every race, color, creed, of every political ideology, of every faith tradition. We have to have more Americans who are willing to tell the truth about the suffering of everyday people. More Americans who are willing to accept the responsibility to simply say what they see. It is impossible to look around these days in this country and to not see the fragility of our democracy. And if we just find the courage, the conviction, the commitment, the character to just tell the truth about what we see, to just say what it is that we see, that at least gets the conversation going. And I trust the American people enough, and I believe in the American people enough, that if the facts are put on the table, if someone commits himself or herself or a network or a newspaper, not to cover the horse race, not to cast in the story of framing it in terms of winners and losers, but to simply tell the truth. Tell the American people the truth, and we can figure this out. But this game of winning versus losing, that's what's going to kill us.